I think I've probably now mapped maybe 70 or 80 different public-private ecosystems in different areas. And the importance of organizations like yours who are holding the whole together and keeping this going over time is absolutely critical to continue the, you know, as Collins talked about, the flywheel effect. And if you don't have organizations that are going to be able to do that, to keep that ecosystem integrated, working together, and so on, you're going to end up with a lot of problems.
That voice was William Eggers, executive director of Deloitte's think tank called the Center for Government Insights, talking about years of momentum that you all have helped to create for more nimble bottom-up ecosystem approaches to strengthening manufacturing and the American project. He talks about his decades of research informing his latest book, Bridge Builders, and the flywheel effect that's accelerating the pace of progress in this, the fourth industrial revolution. His interview coming up next on the podcast, Manufacturing an American Century.
Welcome, Americans. You're listening to the podcast, Manufacturing an American Century, with your host, Matt Boghossian.
Today, we're excited to have with us a popular thought leader, thinker, and writer, William Eggers. Bill, thanks for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you. It's such a wonderful organization that you have, and you're doing such great work for America.
It was great to spend some time with you not too long ago in California. Folks know you through the many books, and a recent one you co-authored is particularly important to our conversation now, Bill. It's called Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. And then you're also the executive director of the Deloitte Center for Government Insights. So let's talk about that first, your role at Deloitte, Bill. Tell us about the Center for Government Insights and what it does.
Great. Well, Deloitte is the world's largest professional services firm. Around the world, we have probably over 450,000 people working with government and the private sector, nonprofits, just about every country and every city in the world. And our Center for Government Insights is kind of like a think tank that Deloitte has created and invested in. And we have a team of 19 scholars who work in our center. We produce anywhere from 70 to this year, close to 100 studies on topics like government technology, management, public-private partnerships, ecosystems, a lot of work on how do we drive cross-sector societal innovation? And now just embarking on a big series looking at America flourishing in 2025 and beyond, and looking at a lot of everywhere from technology to higher education to social welfare, and examining where we are as a country right now. What do we need to do to maintain our leadership in different areas, and where we need some work that needs to be done?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So you're a private firm, Deloitte, that does all of this open source work, and it's great to have Deloitte as one of the many BFFs in our free open source network. Because we have public and private nonprofit leaders from regions across the nation, and think tanks and professional service providers. Like, when did Deloitte realize that this kind of collaborative approach, you know, is a wise investment, you know, for a private company? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've actually been leading Deloitte's research on government and partnerships and so on for over 20 years now. I come from a think tank and a government background. And so I joined the firm about 21 years ago. And over time, we've invested more and more in these capabilities. And the center was created about 6 years ago, just with an amazing team. And everything we publish is available on the free of charge on the internet as a public service to the world, to our clients, and everyone in government and beyond.
And so it's really a recognition that collaboration is necessary for all the different parts of society, like, you know, for making money in the private sector, for sure, but also for public sector actors and nonprofits. And it's great to see that investment, because you obviously, you know, in Deloitte, you have a lot of capacity. And we have some big, hairy problems to solve as a society.
Yeah. And one of the issues is, so I've come from a think tank background, worked at many think tanks, collaborated with many of them over the years. And the majority of work that comes out of a lot of the think tanks is just policy work. A lot of it is great policy work, but, you know, the key lies in the execution. I've written a couple books on execution of big programs. And so we really focus on both the policy design, but even more so on how do you execute these big, complex initiatives. And no organizations have bigger, more complex initiatives and stakeholders and so on than government does. It's much more complex than running any private company. And we're really trying to get to that, to how do you actually manage these? And increasingly, what Bridge Builders is all about is that take any major challenge that we have in America today or most countries and name one where a single organization can solve. And it's almost impossible. Almost every major challenge today requires cross-sector collaboration at a very, very deep level. And that's increasingly recognized by governments all over the world and governors and mayors. But the key is, how do you actually do that? How do you get accountability? How do you bring all the parties together? How do you align incentives? How do you get collaborative co-design with policies and so on? So it's the execution of this, there hasn't been a lot written about it. This is my third book, actually, looking at just that area, because I believe it's so important. I've been so passionate about it. I've worked in public-private partnerships now for 36 years. It's the topic I'm most passionate about. And organizations like yours that do this on a day-to-day basis, bringing them together, you know, are so key. Because what we found, Matt, is oftentimes it's third-party organizations, it's nonprofits, it's others that are able to be those ecosystem integrators and conveners, because they're trusted by all the different parties. So a lot of case studies of organizations like yours and others that are doing really, really important work in society right now in bringing together all these different partners.
Well, yeah. And that's why when we first started working together, it's again a match made in heaven. It was so great to see your thought leadership over the years on this, which is a good transition to your book, your most recent book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. You know, the story of our stakeholders that are going to be listening to this podcast, you know, are, you know, regional players from across the country who, you know, one of the interventions by the federal government that started way back in 2013, 2014, called the IMCP initiative, has led to a whole series of subsequent federal competitions that is trying to elicit this kind of bottom-up public-private partnership methodology. Your book talks about it. In fact, I was listening, Deloitte has a podcast too called The Government Future Frontiers.
Yeah, that's out of our center.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that was awesome. So I was listening to your interview with your co-author of the book, you know, talking about what your book lays out is something we've experienced as a network around the country trying to strengthen American manufacturing. Is really a new model for public management, right?
Absolutely. So I co-authored the book with Don Kettle. And Don, I consider him the dean of public management in the country. And he's been a dean of numerous public policy schools and a professor there. And between us, we've had more than 75 years of experience in the world of public management, more than 35 books published between us. And in that time, we've witnessed a whole cascade of reforms. Some have sought to grow or shrink or devolve or privatize or rewire government. They're all aimed at making public sector more effective and efficient. We've all had lots of good ideas, but it was clear to us after all this time working in this space that what was missing was a strategy for governance in the 21st century, and a strategy that really was about not the mental model people have often of government, which is almost like a vending machine. You put the money, you have a problem, you create an organization, pass legislation, you put the money in and out, supposed to pop the results. And that just doesn't reflect the reality of how actually governments get things done and how we solve big problems. So that mental model was something that we wanted to take on. It simply won't work for many problems we face today. And we wanted to provide another model and then show how the science of actually how to design and implement this for a whole range of issue areas, from climate action to homelessness to workforce development. We focus on many, many different areas in the book, and we apply a lot of these principles, and we look at the cases that actually show the problem. One example of this is when you think about how all these problems extend far beyond these legislative defined boundaries of how we're supposed to deal with them, consider something like homelessness. Is it an economic problem, a jobs problem, a mental health problem, a drug problem, a family problem, criminal justice issue? Is it a problem for government, for nonprofits, for individuals, for local governments or states or federal government? And do private companies care? And the answer to all these questions is yes. And so the solution must go beyond all the old lines we've drawn to address them.
Now we've got this slew of federal interventions that has taken this kind of behavioral science, approach, and invested in it. And it's not just the federal government, state governments have done this too. As we both know, California has a regional kind of bottom up ecosystem approach. What's your take on how we, frame and keep folks motivated on both the big picture and yet, their agency, within their realm of capacity. Yeah.
Well, I think you nailed it. And what you were first saying is the importance of looking at these regionally, especially when you're talking about manufacturing, the green energy transition, homelessness, many other issues. They're not going to be solved at the national level. At the national level, they can provide incentives through tax credits, through loan guarantees, through competitive grant programs, as you mentioned, and all these indirect tools that government has. And in fact, when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, which provided so much money for clean energy, 97% of all that funding was through these kind of indirect tools of government, which is catalyzing these markets and catalyzing these networks. And then it's really that focused on regional solutions. And as you mentioned, California's regions rising together is just such a great example of that, where you have community leaders taking the reins, identifying economic opportunities, regional solutions, promising local initiatives to scale. If Bakersfield foresees a decline in oil revenue, it becomes a prime candidate for clean energy projects in the Bay Area with all the tech prowess. Can collaborate with K-12 programs and higher ed to nurture the next generation of engineers for the green economy. The Inland Empire can pivot to precision agriculture to conserve water. Fresno, with their human capital improvement project, can address the nation's pilot shortage, specifically focusing on electric-powered aircraft. And then you can have things like equity, smarter transit, charging infrastructure, common threads weaving through every region. But by focusing on the regions and what you can do really well and what you can excel in, I think, and giving a lot of autonomy to those regions where I talk about coordination instead of control, I think that's really a way to get uh, to to get past a lot of the sort of wicked problem nature of having these, you know, two massive, massive networks that you're trying to do at a national level, which are going to end up being mired oftentimes in collaboration overload and so on and so forth. So when I've looked at the green energy revolution, most of the really interesting cases and progress is at through regional partnerships and at the regional level. And, you know, the work that you're doing in manufacturing, I think, really brings out the same sort of point that this focus on clusters and regional hubs is really key to making this work.
And underneath all of that is the trust that needs to come together with the different stakeholders. Can you talk a little bit about how what you've seen in your study over your career about the trust necessary for public-private partnerships to succeed and the language of data in terms of and I would say, you know, common data and whatever to drive, you know, ongoing trust for these more, you know, medium to long-term interventions to have success.
Right. And we've written, I think, 18 studies now recently on trust in government and a whole bunch more on societal trust. And as we know, you know, trust in government and institutions in general is at an all-time low right now in America and many other nations for a whole variety of different reasons, increased partisanship, information silos, and on and on. But one of the things we talk about in the book is that if you really want to increase trust here, when you think about these initiatives and what government does, they're all done through a variety of stakeholders, vendors, contractors, other levels of government, private industry. And so you need to create these trust networks where you have trust within these networks. And then trust can be rebuilt by clearly defining and communicating what the mission is, understanding all the stakeholders' needs and perspectives, working through community networks can help build more trust on any number of issues, from building confidence in government services to countering misinformation. You know, one of the stories we talk about in the book is the 2020 census. And when they're about to launch the census in 2020, which we've never had a late census, we've completed it throughout our entire history, despite a civil war, two world wars, depressions, and so on. But here they are facing a pandemic, essentially. They couldn't go door to door. There was massive mistrust in government at the time and the census in general for various reasons. And they had to figure out a way to complete this census through in this incredibly difficult environment. And what they did was they formed partnerships with over 400,000 organizations across the country, everywhere from beauty salons to haircut salons to different clubs and Black churches and so on, and other organizations who had that community level trust, and they could then leverage that trust to complete the census. And they ended up getting 99.98% of households did complete the census in the end, in the middle of a pandemic. It was an amazing story, and they never could have done it without creating these trust networks. And they even hired a whole bunch of individuals whose only job was to be kind of partnership coordinators with all of these organizations.
I think your book is really doing a good job of getting at this, Bill, is creating a science around it so that anybody can go, okay, you know, we need integrators, we need enablers, we need motivators, we need conveners. Yeah. Let's put together our own regional cocktail of what I describe as systems leadership. You know, where are we in terms of standardizing bridge building, so to speak, or systems leadership, and how does metrics play into that? Yeah.
You know, I do, having written on this topic for over three decades and three books, I think we've made a lot of progress. On one hand, it's not really people... don't debate it anymore. I think across both parties, across different ideologies and so on, it's now much more accepted that this is how you address these big issues. This is how we need to go about it. And that is a huge, because that would not have been the case when I started down this road decades ago. Would have been more controversial. There was a lot more distrust between government and the private sector. A lot of them couldn't imagine working together at the time. These public-private relationships increasingly start from co-creation of shared interest, like you see every day and what you're trying to do. And the shift really requires government to rethink relationships with the private sector, especially around issues like accountability. So that's, I think, a really, really important step. Now, I think what we need to focus a lot more on is some of the tougher issues that I hear about in speeches and podcasts around the book, which is how do we train people to be bridge builders? How do we train this next generation of bridge builders? Because as we write in the book, we don't need hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands. We really need millions of bridge builders to tackle these problems and to enhance our competitiveness and so on. And there's not a lot of places to get that training except experientially right now through actually doing that work on the ground. So I think we need a lot more in helping people to understand what systems thinking is all about. How do you effectively execute it? But I'll tell you, Matt, when I speak at graduate schools, which is pretty often, the students there, they absolutely are so enamored by this. They're excited to get involved. They don't want to be kind of stuck in one organization doing something all the time. They want to be working across boundaries and across sectors. So there's a real like excitement and willingness to do this if we could do some more training along those lines. And there's a lot of issues we have to figure out more, which is accountability. We've had a very vertical, hierarchical accountability system, which is very kind of risk averse and so on. But we've been doing a lot of work on agile government and agility, and where we argue that the kind of the previous models and orthodoxies we've been used to in this area, which is that, you know, people think government needs to move slowly because of all the checks and balances and so on. And we can't do that anymore and still thrive. We're in a kind of polycrisis world where we go from one crisis to another, to another, to another, and the speed of change is so fast. We need much more agility in our systems, and that's why these innovation ecosystems and others are so important, and they need to be agile, where you need to be able to shift very quickly. One example that combines some of this, Matt, is a case study that was in the book looking at EARN Maryland. And that's their industry-led workforce redevelopment reskilling program. And what's interesting about EARN Maryland is it's very different than a lot of the other workforce development programs in that industry actually gets together off with organizations like yours, the James Adams Resource Center or Civic Works, and they actually come up with ideas that they proposed to the government, and they ask for grants for that. So rather than the government telling them what to do, the Maryland government says, okay, you guys know this area, you know the workforce skills you need much better than we do. You come up with the proposals for doing these things collaboratively. And it's really been remarkable how much more agile that system is. What I hear from all the providers of workforce development is that because the changes in industry come so quickly in manufacturing and wind and solar and so on, they need to be able to move very, very quickly around the new skills that they need. And that program allows them to do so. For government, it means oftentimes they'll put in an investment into these training programs, but then the private sector might even double that. So I think thinking much more in a much more agile way and giving a lot more freedom to innovate and to do that quickly through these sort of ecosystems and having integrators who are very, very deeply knowledgeable about that individual industry. whether it's one of the organizations I looked at, is, you know, they focus on welding and advanced welding, which is so important for manufacturing in the future. Another one was really focused on wind power, which in states like Maryland or Texas are becoming increasingly important, not only energy source, but a huge source of green jobs right now.
So check it out, right? We have this historic time right now of federal public interventions to help regions. And this is great. Some people have compared it to the New Deal, but it's not going to last, right? There just needs to be a lot more capacity for this, you know, bottom-up bridge building approach. And you know, the public interventions to support it are not systemic. They're episodic.
And right.
So how do we make it more systemic, the support for these bottom-up, you know, integrations? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the key things is to show the catalytic impact of public funding here. I've got a whole chapter of the book on it. And when you look at let's just take the Inflation Reduction Act alone, it's already produced more than $270 billion in new public and private investments in clean energy projects. Companies have now announced plans to invest an additional $408 billion in clean energy. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates that it's going to end up producing about $3 trillion in private investments into clean energy. Now that's a massive catalytic effect and return for government in many respects, and being able to show that sort of impact. But in order to keep that going, they need organizations like AMCC as conveners and integrators of these networks to make sure that they're all working together, to make sure that this sustains over time. And I think it's really going to be an educational thing to get people to understand that. But I think I've probably now mapped maybe 70 or 80 different public-private ecosystems in different areas. And the importance of organizations like yours who are holding the whole together and keeping this going over time is absolutely critical to continue the, you know, as Collins talked about, the flywheel effect. And if you don't have organizations that are going to be able to do that, to keep that ecosystem integrated, working together, and so on, you're going to end up with a lot of problems. The idea is that a lot of this investment creates a lot of market dynamics, and the markets then become self-sustaining. But I do think that the ecosystem conveners and integrators like yours are really key to this long-term success here. So it's going to just be a lot more education and, you know, hopefully, you know, people writing about it like myself and showing incredible results like you do will help get us there.
Yeah, we're definitely making progress. Directionally, I think we're making progress. It's the speed, of our progress that is something we have to continually work on. What's your argument to private sector folks as to their, you know, the need for them to invest in public-private partnerships, and integrator groups and stuff like that? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I wrote a lot about this in the previous HBR book I did called The Solution Revolution. And if you look back to the 70s and early 80s, companies saw their only role as really to increase shareholder value. And they were just focused on that. There was no such thing really as a double and triple bottom line, looking at wider societal goals and how to meet those. And yet today we have trillions of dollars going in from the private sector to create public value and to help solve a lot of these societal problems. If you look at almost every major Fortune 500 company, they have a set of issues where they want to be at the center of helping to solve different issues and different problems. And so that's a real rethinking. Every Sweden, corporate America, and many other countries, they have people who are really passionate about this, who are working on purpose, who are committing funding to these. At Deloitte, we've committed over $1 billion just in the climate area. And doing so, we're partnering with many, many organizations all over the country who are really good at doing this ecosystem integration and convening and so on. And we can provide a role in helping them in different ways and helping them not only with funding, but a lot of consulting help. So I actually think there's a lot of self-interest from a commercial standpoint to be involved in these organizations, especially as they focus more and more on this double and triple bottom line and purpose. And just, you know, frankly, from a pure economic standpoint, what this transition is going to look like overall. We're in the middle of a fourth industrial revolution. And we're in the second half of it now. What we've seen in previous industrial revolutions is this is where a lot of the big changes occur. And you know, in a lot of pushback oftentimes, you know, we saw with the Luddites way back when. And so you really need organizations who are providing that sort of convening capability to bring a lot of the parties together and help to explain all the advantages and to ensure that we do have a just transition. And I think that's one of the areas that a lot more focus on today than we would have seen in previous industrial revolutions, whether from the steam engine or electricity, and really making sure we're creating more jobs than we're destroying, that we're providing upskilling opportunities in underserved communities, and adopting policies to incentivize workforce development and new manufacturing and green workforce and so on and so forth. And industry needs to be a player at the table. And I think that's increasingly recognized.
So, Bill, you're fired up about this work. You know, as we wrap this thing up, you know, we have AMCC's got these stakeholders all over the country and regions trying to figure out how to strengthen their regional ecosystem. Some are in the private sector, some in the public sector, nonprofit. What final messages do you have to them to motivate them to stay in the game?
In all these annals of technology history, we've seen these clashes between innovation and tradition. You know, it's this timeless tale woven with threads of resistance, resilience, revolution. And think about, you know, when we go to the steam engine, it casts a long shadow over once dominant windmills and water mills that had powered economies for generations, and the dawn of decentralized electricity generation ushered in a whole era of disruption and conflict and outdated regulations, which had been crafted an era long gone. They strained under the weight of all this innovation and how to handle it. We're in the middle of another one of these industrial revolutions, and it's both exciting and it's also scary for a lot of people. But I think in the end, the engines of progress really propel societies into the future. And, you know, one of, I love the work Jim Collins has done on the flywheel effect. And I think that idea has really transcended business to describe how these systems mature in many respects. The effect describes how companies can become exceptional from the accumulation of little efforts over the years if you properly align and create their own momentum, fueling a self-reinforcing cycle. You work hard enough to start a flywheel, it's easy to keep it spinning. And when you think about what we've talked about, Matt, where we need this symphony of sectors that in the pursuit of a net zero future or the future of manufacturing and like charging a flywheel, each investment is going to build a cycle speed. Early adopters will generate more demand. Producers will innovate to meet that demand. Costs lower due to improvements and further stimulates demand. And so once you get that flywheel started, which I think we've seen, and I think these pieces of legislation I've talked about have played a good role in that, it has tremendous momentum. And so we're in that stage. There's a lot of momentum. There's going to be obstacles all the way through. We just need to keep on pushing up, adding that up, and letting that momentum keep going. And because we're entering a new world, and I'm actually really optimistic about it.
Yeah, so am I, and increasingly so every time I talk to you, Bill. It's great to have you on the podcast. Executive Director of Deloitte's Center for Government Insights and author of the fantastic book, Bridge Builders, How Governments Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. Bill Eggers, thanks for being on the podcast.
Oh, it was such a pleasure, Matt. Thank you so much. And again, thank you for the incredibly important work that you and AIMCC are doing.
You can learn more about AMCC and joining our weekly mailing list at americanmcc.org/subscribe. If you're a manufacturer, economic development professional, workforce and trading person, capital provider, or work in any field critical to American manufacturing, send us a note. We'd love to hear about progress from your part of the ecosystem and join us on our Monday calls. The next episode of this podcast, Manufacturing in the American Century, will be coming out soon. So in the meantime, spread the word by sharing about AMCC and the podcast on your Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Manufacturing in the American Century is available on Spotify and all major podcast platforms. Thanks for our production partners, AMCC Operations Director David Van Sicklin and Mr. Mike McCallum from Podcasting for Associations. That's it for now. I'm Matt Boghossian with you, Manufacturing in the American Century.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.